The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Greetings from the Eternal Church of God, and welcome everybody who's attending here in Billings, and welcome to those who might be attending on the phone hookup, on the electronic means, via the internet. There are a number of people that use our services, most of which have little to no contact with us. It'd be nice to hear from people once in a while. Occasionally we do hear from people, but regardless, it's okay. But if you are attending and you do appreciate some of the things that we're doing here, it'd be nice to reach out and say hello. We can pass those greetings along to those people in the group attending with us here in Billings. And during the Q&A session, I will remind people that we do have a Q&A after services. It's a by invite Q&A. It's on a different conferencing number, and if you are interested in attending that part of our Sabbath observance, you're welcome to do so if you contact us, and we'll get further details to you. Rebellion against authority is nothing new to mankind. Of course, we understand it began with Eve when she chose to disobey God's command to not take from the forbidden fruit, and Adam followed suit. And since that time, the human race has had a long history of rebellion against authority, but not God's authority alone. You see, when communities were established soon afterward, as people began to, as populations increased and people began to spread to various parts of the earth, the Bible says that in Genesis 6, you don't have to go there, but the Bible says that there were tyrants in the earth at that time, people who built names for themselves through violence, through tyranny, and the authority of good men became scarce during that time, causing God to intervene on behalf of those few people who respected good authority. And after the flood, when states, when nations, kingdoms, even empires were established, the world has seen decades, centuries, even millennia of people who would eventually attempt to topple the established authority and to take control for themselves. Now, sometimes the intent may have been to give power to the people. Sometimes that was simply an excuse leading to dictatorships that ended up being a worse form of authority that was in place than beforehand. But even they, even when this happened, even that did not last for very long, relatively speaking. Now, in America today, we have what I would say is the second best form of government that has led to the greatest nation that this earth has ever seen, the greatest nation in history. And yet, there is a rising tide of rebellion against authority in this country. Disrespect of the office of the president, disrespect of those who serve in positions of enforcing authority, whether it be mayors, governors, or armed forces, or the police force in this country. It's widespread in the country today. It's not the majority, but it is widespread. And we watch what is happening in the world today, and it saddens us to see such things occur. We might even feel angry about what is going on in the nation of America. And the reason some people are angered by what is happening as far as this rebellion against authority, this mob mentality as some portray it, is because those people who are upset with it have a respect for good authority and understand that it's right to have an authority in the land. Now, when a person desires to obey God, such as ourselves, so one of the things that we learn to accept is respect for authority. And we no longer choose to do what's right in our own eyes. Of course, we prove things for ourselves, we prove what is right for ourselves. And we forego, of course, the notion that, you know, we have the moral authority on our own shoulders, that we can choose for ourselves to decide what is right and what is wrong. And so we need to submit, therefore. We learn to submit to the leading authority of the universe, the Word of Truth, the manual for mankind. And so we learn in this way that God's laws are not oppressive. The Bible calls them, says that they are not a burden, that they are for our own benefit. We learn of the immeasurable value that God's authority has when it is obeyed in our lives. To all who obey God's law, God's rule of law, they will be of immense value and a great benefit. We don't always see the benefits now. We do experience them, but we know we will experience the full measure of those benefits in the future. Let's go over to John 18. John chapter 18. Now, interestingly, the word authority comes from the root word author. The word author refers to somebody who originates or initiates something that, you know, generates something that has not previously existed in one form or another. Perhaps there is a new version, the author of something perhaps new. There is still a measure of new understanding that the Church of God has been experiencing over the years and will continue to experience, I believe, till Christ returns and reveals all truth to all of us. And so clearly, the origin or author of our existence is God. He is the author of law and order. And Jesus understood this. He understood the importance of authority. And even when he was brought before the leading authority of Jerusalem during his ministry, a gentleman by the name of Pontius Pilate, an employee or subject, if you will, of Rome, he was the leading authority in Judea at that time, and Pontius Pilate asked Jesus some interesting questions, and Christ gave him some profound answers. In John 18, verse 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium. Some translations call it the judgment hall, I believe, because basically the Praetorium is talking about a governor's courtroom, a place where judgments take place, councils, meetings, what have you. But they themselves, the Jews here that brought him there, didn't go into the Praetorium lest they should be defiled, that they may eat the Passover, and not that going into this Gentile home would have actually defiled them, but it was just a law they created of themselves. It's a law of Judaism, not a law of the Scriptures, going into a Gentile home, to somehow defiling oneself. But Pilate, he went out to meet them, verse 29, and says, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered, they said to him, "Well, if you were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." As if that's, no, that's really not the terms, the accusations. That's kind of like saying, look, just believe us. He's done wrong. Well, Pilate said to them, and I think this is in response to, well, you're not really giving me the terms here. You're not giving me any evidence. So he said, well, you take him then and judge him according to your law. And therefore the Jews said to him, well, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Ah, I see what you want now. He understood. He wanted them to condemn this man, to condemn Christ to death. And this is that the saying might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by which death he would die, that is, of crucifixion. Well, then Pilate entered the Praetorium again, and he called Jesus, and he said to him, "Are you a king of the Jews?" So he's asking him, it's a good question, because apparently this is one of the accusations. He claims he's a king over these people. And so he's asking him, "Are you an authority to these people? Do you claim to be an authority over these people?" Well, Jesus answered and said, "Well, are you speaking for yourself about this? I mean, is this something you were wondering about? Or did others tell you this concerning me?" Well, Pilate answered and said, "Am I a Jew?" You know, in other words, I'm not claiming that you're my king. Am I a Jew? "But your own nation, it says, the chief priests, they have delivered you to me. So what have you done?" Well, Jesus gave him a response, basically saying, yes, I am a king. And he said it in this way. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world." So his kingdom was not of what he was talking about. It's not of this age. Yes, he will be the king over this world, but his kingdom was not yet. It wasn't going to be established yet. not in this present age or world. If my kingdom were of this world, he said, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now, as of now, my kingdom is not from here. So this shows us, well, Christ wasn't necessarily a pacifist like many people portray him to be. In other words, he was saying, if this were my kingdom right now, my servants, the people that follow me, would fight against you. So there is a time to fight against wrongful authority. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Bad authority, to stand up for what is right. But he's saying, well, my kingdom's not from here right now. My servants are not going to fight against this. So Pilate therefore said to him, well, are you a king then? You know, I guess maybe he thought he was beating around the bush here. I think he made it pretty clear. But Jesus answered here plainly now and said, you say rightly that I am a king. And for this cause I was born, to be a king. And for this cause I've come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth, who believes the truth, who adheres to the truth, and in other words, adhering to God's authority, he hears my voice. So they understand what he's talking about. They understand what he is saying to them. Well, Pilate said to him then, what is truth? Something we hear frequently today as people try to redefine good as being evil and evil as being good. Well, what's truth? It's relative. It's relative to the situation or the time. It's not true at all. Truth is truth, regardless of what age or what time or what occasion, what situation. And when Pilate had said this to him, he went out again to the Jews and said, well, I find no fault in him at all. So he didn't find anything wrong with what he was saying. There was nothing. He wasn't trying to cause a revolt against the authorities in Jerusalem or Judea. Not at all. He didn't find any fault with what Christ was saying here. He was saying, well, yeah, I'm an authority figure. And I have a measure of authority. But I'm not exercising all that authority right now because my kingdom's not of this age or of this world. And in this way, he was saying, I submit to you, Pilate. I'm submitting to your authority. You're the authority in this world, in this kingdom, in this area right now. I'll submit to that authority. And so we see, therefore, that Christ indicated that God delegates authority as he sees fit. God allowed Pilate to become the leading authority in Judea at that time. Jesus was willing to submit to that authority, even when it was not entirely fair. He still submitted to that authority. And the reason is because Christ recognized, and we need to recognize, that God allows people, he even causes, at times, kings, statesmen, presidents, governors, even religious authorities, ministers, elders, to rise up, to be put in place, to serve a purpose, to serve his purpose. Now, obviously, not all of them are just in every way. They're still human. People make mistakes. Sometimes God allows an authority to rise up, whether it's a president, a governor, perhaps even a minister in the church, because that's what the people deserve at that time. People are not desiring to do what's right. Okay, let's put a man in charge who you want to be in charge. Let's see how that goes for you. So, in this way, we think that we see that a few of the statesmen in recent years, and even over the millennia, that few of them would be considered righteous. Of course, there is the kings of old, some of the kings during the time of ancient Israel and Judea, who would be considered righteous kings, righteous rulers. There were righteous priests, ministers, what have you, and are even still today. But even if they are not, their leadership is allowed to stand so that certain events will transpire, that certain things will take place, and that God's plan will be fulfilled in this way. And so we need to wonder, when we're fighting against the authority, when we're fighting against something, could it be that we're fighting against God in this way? You know, this is one of the reasons why we choose not to vote. Because who does God want in charge? We might want this guy in charge because he's more like us. He has more values that are like ours. Maybe that's not what the nation deserves. Could we be fighting against God if we vote for the person we want? And he says, no, I want this person. Daniel 2, verse 21, I believe, says God sets up kings. He puts kings, presidents, what have you, in positions of authority to serve his purposes. Let's go over to Proverbs 29. Proverbs 29. Even long before the existence of mankind, we see that God put a magnificent archangel that is referred to or called Lucifer in the scriptures. This individual was given a large measure of authority over the earth. And for untold millennia, this archangel had authority over legions of angels. And these angels saw the earth go through various stages of development. And it was not until Lucifer turned against God, against his authority, that God said, okay, the time is right. I will create humankind. And we see he created Adam and Eve. He recreated the flora and the fauna and the earth as we know it today. And yet Satan, even though Satan rebelled, we see that Satan, his name was changed or is now referred to as Satan, the adversary, that he still maintains a level of authority on the earth. It's God-given authority. Doesn't mean that God agrees with everything that is done, but he maintains that office. And it says even that Michael, that great archangel Michael, didn't bring a railing accusation against the devil because he understood he has a position of authority. And that's God's place to do that. It wasn't his place. So Satan is going to be replaced as an authority on this earth, and yet he still has it. He hasn't been replaced yet. He's still a magistrate, if you will, of the earth. And so Paul, for this reason, called him a god of this age. Some of the translations say of this world. It basically means the god of this age, because people obey his authority more than they do the god of creation. And so his values are allowed, therefore, to stand in this world as an option. God doesn't want people to choose that option, but they're allowed to stand as an option so that people will be allowed to choose them if they want and learn firsthand by experience, hands-on experience, what will happen if you choose the wrong way. Here's how it's going to go. Oh, yeah, it might seem good for a time. We're living it up. We're having a good old time. But in the end, you realize, oh, here's where it goes. It goes to pain. It goes to suffering. Ultimately, to death, if we continue down that road. So Satan, therefore, is the author of rebellion. You could call him the author. He's called the father of lies in the scriptures. They refer to him as being a murderer from the beginning. Because we understand hate is the first step toward murder. And his attitude, the devil's attitude of dissatisfaction and his hatred of laws that prohibit wicked behavior, this attitude is allowed to be broadcast around the earth. And most people, in fact, tune in to his wavelength like we tune into a good radio. Oh, I love that song. Let's try to tune in a little clearer to that song. People tune right into it because, that's what they want. Many people want to choose those things that are forbidden. They want to have no authority over their lives, to choose for themselves what is right and what is wrong. And we all, in fact, every one of us, we all pick up on his signals at times. Even us, sitting right here, people listening on the internet or the phone hookup. We all pick up on Satan's signals from time to time. Sometimes we listen and we go, I like that. That's appealing. We've got to learn to go, no, I'm not going to listen to that because I understand that it's wrong. There are reasons why it is wrong. But the point is, more people in the earth outside the church, of course, would pick up on his wavelengths more than people within the church. But everybody does in varying degrees. And in this way, I think everybody, even people in the church, resists authority from time to time. Rebellion and civil unrest is a part of history. It's a part of human history. It's a part of the nation's history, every nation's history. But even so, it doesn't mean that it's right. It doesn't mean that it's natural for us to go that way. But we see it happening today. Again, we see even many people in positions of authority, some mayors and governors and other statesmen and women, they're trying to justify these waves of violence that are taking place across the country. They're trying to, so I've heard some even quoted as saying, violence is a part of American history. Rebellion is a part of our history, as if they're trying to rewrite history to say, well, these evil forms of violence and rebellion are okay because it's a part of our history. They make it sound as though because we fought for freedom and justice in the past, that somehow condones wickedness and evil, because they're both violent at times. But this isn't true. You see, God never intended this. God never wanted Lucifer to rebel. That wasn't what he had hoped. He just allowed it to take place. And it took a long, long time. It wasn't like it happened overnight. We don't know how many millions of years it may have taken for one of the angels to turn. But God did not want this to happen. It wasn't his intent. He didn't desire for people to rebel against his law. And he has never desired for mankind to rebel against God's authority. And so authority figures in this world, we see, have many faces or many offices. You might call them offices. Some of them are easy to submit to, and we could call these good forms of authority. Others are difficult to submit to, and I would, you know, for us here, we would call those bad forms of authority. But people outside the church, of course, would think differently about this, and they would switch the roles or the attitudes or the behaviors, and, you know, and this is because there's a plague of injustice going on around the country today. There's a plague of injustices actually that have been going on for many decades from the top down, as people in positions of authority have continued to find new ways and new methods of getting around, of skirting the law, of breaking the law, and yet getting away with it. And so people are thinking differently about it, thinking differently. And this wave of rebellion against authority is growing in this country. But regardless, we would say, it would be our judgment, our opinion, I should say, that the offices of authority in this country are still mostly considered good, at least, you know, in how they should be played out. The office of a mayor or governor or the president is a good office if they rule righteously, if they do things that are good for the people, that are positive, and not just a matter of an opinion of what is good and positive. But there are many politicians, of course, that are corrupt in this country. They misuse their authority, but that's really beside the point. The laws of this country, as they were designed, are vastly good, vastly just and fair. They're decent laws that are good for the citizens of the United States of America. And in many ways, we would consider, well, most of them are righteous laws because they are based on biblical values. And it's no secret, although people are trying to bury it today, it's no secret that when the laws in this country were created, that those who created these laws, that designed the Constitution, they were reading the Bible. And God is mentioned hundreds, if not thousands of times in the pages of history when people created this country, established this country as a nation. And that is what made this nation great. Not the freedom to choose evil, but the freedom to do what is right, according to an understanding of the scriptures. Well, Proverbs 29 and verse 2 says this, says that when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. Now, we would agree with this statement. Now, many, of course, many who do not respect the God of the Bible as the leading authority would not agree because their perspective of righteousness comes from a twisted idea, of course, that good is evil and evil is good. But when the wicked rule, we see that the nation or those people that they rule over begin to have problems, difficulties that are uncomfortable to most, usually the citizens, the people on the lower end. It's always felt, mostly by the common people, who are the majority, but when there are fair, what this scripture is saying is when there are fair, when there are honest authorities, things go well. Things go well for the people, for the nation, in our case, or for the business. And this is how America became the greatest nation that this country, that this world has ever seen. Now, not everything done in this country was right and just. No. It seldom is when men rule over nations or over organizations. Not everything is completely righteous or accurate, but most things were good and fair and just. And most of the world has benefited from the establishment of America, the existence of the United States of America. And the reason is directly connected to authority. Romans 13 The family structure is another example of this. Because the family structure has a foundation, if you will, of having respect, honor, as the fifth commandment puts it. We talked about this quite a bit last week. Respect for the authority of the parents. However, many kids grow to dislike the authority that parents have in their lives. All children, I think, and teenagers in particular, undergo a measure of rebellion against authority in their lives and the authority of their parents. Now, my upbringing, I think, was a fairly common one. I was raised to have a measure of respect and understanding for law and order, authority, if you will, and the importance of this in a society. But in my teenage years, you know, I, like many teenagers, I desired to have to do some things that were against the law. I wasn't a criminal. I wasn't like a bad kid. Well, I guess it's a matter of opinion. But anyway. But my rebellion, in some ways, of doing those things that were not right was tolerated in many respects by my parents. I look back, of course, at many of the things I had done, and I regret them, because when I was caught for doing some of these things, I, for the most part, I didn't really get reprimanded for them, or the reprimand perhaps was not too severe. Just a good talking to. That doesn't always work with kids, especially rebellious ones like I was. But there were other major struggles in my family at the time, and so I do understand that this led, I think, it likely led to my parents not being strict enough. Now, at the time, I was quite happy about that. I really enjoyed just kind of doing what I want, even when it was against the law, you know. I wasn't out robbing or stealing or breaking, you know, what have you. But in any case, I liked it at the time. In fact, the home that I grew up in became kind of a hangout for many of my friends because my parents put up with a lot of that stuff going on. Outside, we built a band room, this really large band room, one of the first bands I played in. We rehearsed in there, and many days and nights were spent in that room and doing things at times that were not right for teenagers or anybody really at times to be doing. But I look back now and I think, well, I wish my parents would have laid down the law more often than not, that they would not have put up with those things. And the reason is because learning to submit to authority from an early age, learning to submit to good authority is learning to respect and honor God. It's learning to submit to the authority of God. Because respect for authority in our lives, even from an early age, is a reflection of our respect for God. And this is why Paul wrote this in Romans 13, and we're going to read the first seven verses, where he said, "Render therefore to all," beginning in verse 7. Verse 1, "Let every soul or life, person, individual, be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God." Like I had said in Daniel 2:21, he sets up kings, he sets up leaders, he sets up parents, bosses, ministers even. "And therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil." In other words, that's what they were designed to be. "And do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do you do what is good, and you will have praise from the same? For he or they," speaking of authorities, figures, "are God's ministers to you for good. But if you do evil, will be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil." So this is talking about basically getting in trouble from the law, having to pay the penalty for breaking the law. "And therefore you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake." And that's what I'm getting at. Not just because it's breaking the law, not just because it's, you know, going against the authority, but for conscience' sake. "For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear or respect, reverence to whom reverence, and honor to whom honor." So there is a level of respect or honor that is due to statesmen, that is due to policemen, that is due to the president, that is due to ministers, that is due to parents, that is due to our bosses. These are all forms of authority that we are to learn to respect in life. And so, for this reason, we pay taxes. It's out of respect, not just for the authority, but in like manner, we tithe out of respect for God, the leading authority in our lives, because he says, here's what you do. So we do it, and we understand the reason for it. It serves a good purpose. So God put people in those positions of authority, and by so doing, we are told to honor them. And when we do this, we honor God's decision. We honor the fact that God allowed, you know, he either set it up, intended it for it to happen directly, or he allowed it to happen because that's what they deserve. But many, I think, misunderstand this concept of honor to whom honor is due, respect to whom respect, because some mistake honor and respect to blind obedience. And that is not always the case. That's not what we are actually to do, just blind obedience. If we don't quite understand, I think we go along. We do it because they are the authority. But if we want to understand more, there's nothing wrong with questioning it. There's nothing wrong with going to the authority figures, the people that uphold a measure of the law and order, and those measures that do not violate the scriptures. And even if we think we are violating the scriptures, we can question, well, what's the purpose? What is the reason for this? You know, America has a form of government that has grown increasingly corrupt over the last several decades, but the law still stands, as I had said. It still falls within the boundaries of laws that are just and good. They serve a purpose of justice. They're not always, justice is not always served, I think, because some of the courtrooms have become corrupt as well. But they are there to preserve life and liberty, the freedoms that you and I have all enjoyed. And yet we see America experiencing an upheaval of rebellion against these authorities that have provided life and liberty and justice. And there are pockets, we see then, of mobs that are sanctioning violence and against police, and they're trying to rewrite history, even as we see them trying to take down monuments and statues and what have you, things that are there to preserve the history of this country, as if it never happened, so that they can then let's reestablish those laws, let's redefine those laws. I think that's what we see trying to happen in many cases. But my point is that some statesmen are attempting to use this upheaval. We see that there are some authority figures in the country that are misusing their position. They're trying to use the unrest, if you will, of many people to push their own agenda, to get their own party in charge, to get somebody out and get their people in. And we see that some are making outlandish, even false, just outright false accusations against others. And it's happening on both sides. On both sides. What I see happening is more on the left than it is on the right, but it still is happening on both sides. And in this way, I think the death of a George Floyd has sparked what somebody else called, and I agree with, national derangement is happening in the country today. Now, so blind obedience to authority is not the answer, but neither is blind rebellion against authority. Because I think that's what we see happening, blind rebellion, taking one injustice and trying to say that, well, this is justifies trying to tear apart the whole system. Just tear it all down. Do away with authority in this country. I even heard a crazy interview from some expert professor in some college saying that we need to do away with misdemeanors, that those should not be breaking the law. Even insinuating most people break those every single day and they don't even really think about it. So let's just do away with those. Okay, what's next? Well, I was justified in killing that person. They deserved it. That's the next step. Sounds a little, you know, some people say, you're taking a step too far. But hey, that's where we're headed. If people allow this to continue. So the point is, blind rebellion is not the answer either. We need to understand the difference because, you know, I think even in the Church of God, we have seen a measure of rebellion in the Church of God, rebellion against authority. Ephesians 4. There are some who have assumed that those ordained as ministers should be able to dictate every step that we take in life, what kind of car we should buy, what kind of color we should paint our homes, you know, things. And I'm, of course, being a little silly about it, but in some cases, people would say, those are personal choices. You know, ministers are not there to dictate every decision we make in life. And some ministers, I think, have misused their authority in the church. Many have made mistakes because they are people too. Yeah, we look back and say, well, they should have known better. They're people too. They're learning too. I was talking to my wife about this the other day. You know, it seems like being a father now of a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old, seems like I've learned a lot about parenting. And sometimes I think, and I was just thinking the other day, I'm still learning. This is still a process here. And so it is with everybody in a position of authority. You don't step into that position knowing everything and always making the right choice, the right decision every time. No, we're going to make mistakes. We're all going to make mistakes. And we should be a little more forgiving of that. But because some ministers have misused their authority, some ministers have made mistakes, we see that there are pockets of rebellion in the church. I've had conversations, exchanged emails, and what have you with a number of these pockets of rebellion in the church across the country. And like those people who latch on to the few unjust acts of some bad cops, if you let me put it in those terms, and then think that we need to tear down the whole system, some in the church, I think, like to latch on to some of those mistakes, those bad choices, the misuse of authority at times that ministers have had, and then think, well, we can discount all the good that's been done. That's what people are doing to the police today. We're just going to discount all the good that they've done for the country for hundreds of years Just tear it all down. And some people do something similar in the church. We're just going to discount everything that's been done over the last 8 or 9 decades with ordained ministers in the church, and we're going to do it ourselves. We'll take it upon ourselves to be the authority figures in the church. So there are growing numbers who feel that there is really no need to respect ordained elders in the church. There are many people who choose to just sit on the sidelines and just kind of be concerned onlookers and maybe, you know, benefit from the, whether it's the sermons or the publications that ministers may put out in the church. But there are others who have presumptuously started their own work thinking, well, I can do better. I can do better than those people that put in position, that God put in, people in positions of authority. Now, there's an algorithm, if you let me call it that, that's rather simple in this regard. If somebody tells us to do something that is wrong, according to the Bible, we're not obligated to do it. We should not do it. Now, when Peter and the other apostles were told by the leading authorities of Judea, the religious authorities, I should say, of Judea, when they were told not to preach Christ, they answered and said this: we ought to obey God rather than men. And so this is a principle that is always the case. We always ought to obey God rather than men. But it doesn't mean that we are to become our own authority, our own moral authority in particular. See, Christ ordained individuals to be leaders in the church. They serve a purpose. And that ordination actually began with Aaron, much, you know, thousands of years ago. And there was a succession after that of people who were to serve as ministers in the temple and religious authorities. And then we see Christ, him ordaining apostles to serve in the church who were instructed to ordain elders and deacons to serve in the church. That succession has been passed down from history ever since that time. In Ephesians 4 and verse 11, Paul said he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And so we see people are put in positions of authority for service. It's for the edification of the saints. It's not to serve their own benefit, to try to exalt themselves or try to get, you know, something for out for it, for themselves out of it. It is to serve others. Now, it's true, like in all organizations, in all nations, that there are some that come in with self-serving purposes in some ways. But that's beside the point. That it really is beside the point. Because we can learn from those who God has placed in positions of authority. We can learn to have respect for authority and learn that they are there, truly they are supposed to serve the greater good. And even when the priest that taught Samuel, the prophet Samuel, Eli, wasn't it Eli? Even when his two sons abused their positions in the ministry, God never told the people, stop supporting the ministry. Stop tithing, stop supporting the temple. Because those individuals are corrupt. Never, ever. He understood that you can't tell people to stop disrespecting the people, those individuals that he put in positions of authority. Because then it just becomes every man doing what's right in his own eyes. So we can learn from this, much like we learn from our parents who were our authority figures while we were young, and we still continue to have respect for our parents today if they're still living. Honor your mothers, or your fathers and your mothers. Now, I had an argument with one group in California who chose to become an independent group. They have no ordained ministry, but they have their own Sabbath services. They hold their own holy days. And there's nothing wrong with people that don't have an ordained minister to have Sabbath services on their own. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But when it comes to holding holy day services, when it comes to taking in tithes and offerings and doing what they feel is appropriate to do with those things, I have a problem with that because the scriptures never tell us that that's allowed. They never, ever say. I even had somebody at one time calling me to ask, you know, what should I do with this? I want to give it to this organization or, you know, the Breast Cancer Foundation or what have you. And I said, you're on your own on this one. I'm not going to sanction anything outside of what the Bible says. It says to give it to the ministry. I can't help you by putting a stamp of approval. Just because people don't like some of the things some ministers have done doesn't mean we can take measures into our own hands and do what we want. So in any case, I tried to show some of these individuals where they were off track in a few ways. And I was using the scriptures in my responses. And one of the people had given me a response in this way. They said, I have the Spirit of God. I don't need a minister to tell me what to do. How do you argue with that? I mean, sure, we all have the Spirit of God, and we need to rightly divide the word of truth. That's really not the point. The point is, I'm trying to show you, here's where it's wrong. And you're saying, I don't need a minister to tell me what to do, because I have God's Spirit. To me, that's a form of rebellion against authority. And we see it happening in various parts of the country with various people in the church because they don't like something. They don't like a minister. They don't like something that took place in the past or in the present. There are mistakes happening today. And sadly, those mistakes are growing in some organizations. But, you know, people don't like to be corrected. They don't want to be told that this is wrong. Our pride, you know, the pride of life, as it's called, that leads to a great many sins, the pride of life, is something that's hard to overcome. We don't like to be corrected. But blind rebellion is not the answer. It's not what the Bible warns us about when questioning authority. Ephesians 5, probably just turn over one page. There are ordained authorities in the world that serve different offices, and when we choose to rebel against them, we better be careful, because it's equated, Paul equates it to rebelling against the authority of God. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't question authority. It doesn't mean we can't ask questions, you know, whether it's ministers or statesmen or our boss. We should be able to ask questions or express our concerns when something doesn't seem right. And those who understand the proper use of authority, who are in those positions, they should be receptive to questions and receptive to concerns. You know, we think about Abraham. Abraham, we have an example of Abraham questioning God when God said, I'm going to destroy all the people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And he didn't question God's authority, but he said, well, what about this? God, have you thought about this? And then God said, well, okay, for their sake, I won't do it for that many. And then God said, well, I have another question or concern. What about if there's only 30? And, the number got lower and lower, and God was receptive to this. He didn't say, who are you to question me? Moses did something similar. When God said, Moses, I'm fed up. I'm going to destroy all these people, and I'm going to make a great nation out of you. And God said, well, what about this, God? Moses said, what about this, God? What about the fact that, you know, you have a reputation among one of the greatest empires the world had ever seen at that time, Egypt. You brought your people out. How's it going to look if you just kill everybody, and then, you know, I'm the only one left? I think God had reasons for proposing this option. He was trying to get Moses invested. But the point is God didn't say, who are you to question me, Moses? No, he was willing to listen because it was a just concern. And so those who serve offices of authority are there to serve. And they hold that office for the greater good, whether it's to serve a business or a community of faith or a nation. In our case, you know, a community of faith. And so those who are put in positions of authority in the church, they need to learn how to rule justly and right. They need to learn to rightly divide the word of truth, and they should be willing to listen to questions or concerns that brethren might have. Now, if this is not the case, then I would put it in a category of a misuse of authority. That they're not rightly dividing the word of truth, or perhaps they're just unwilling to listen. You know, they're allowing personal feelings to get in the way of what they should do as an authority figure in the church. And God's going to deal with that. And I think that's why he didn't tell the people during the time of Eli to stop supporting the ministry. Because he'll deal with those people. And he did deal with both of those individuals. Those two individuals died. So God is going to deal with it. It's not up to us to take matters into our own hands to decide what we're going to do. And so Paul, he wrote that in fact it is our job to submit to authority, and he gave us the example of God's design of the family. And I read a little bit of this last week, so I'm not going to talk about it in its entirety, but or at least a portion of this chapter, I believe. What I'm going to read, though, is not politically correct in our age. People would not agree with some of these things that are said here. And frankly, there are some people, even within the church, that might feel a little uncomfortable about hearing these words. But they are truth, and we need to listen to them. So Ephesians 5, in verse 22, it says, "Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. And therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." Well, there's been a feminist movement in this country for many years now, and in some respects, that movement led to a few, or perhaps several, positive changes. But it had gotten to the point to where many women feel that they are equal to the authority of the husband, sometimes better than the authority of the husband, and that's a problem. It's like the church saying, we're equal to the authority of Christ. We're better, in fact, to the authority of Christ. Some organizations kind of have taken matters into their own hands when it comes to Protestant organizations, Catholic organizations. They say that they are better because they say, here is how we're going to interpret the scriptures. We're not going to let the scriptures interpret themselves. We're going to take things out of context. We're going to use them as we see fit. That's what we're being warned against here. And we have the example from the very beginning of our existence as children in the family structure, who have the authority figures of the father and then the mother. There is a hierarchy here, and the father is the head of the family. And so husbands, it says, but just because fathers or men are the head of the family doesn't mean we can abuse those positions. We can misuse the authority that we might have in the family. It says in verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives." And so, you know, some of you men out there might be going, "Well, I love my wife. I love her." Well, do we always treat our wives like we love them? Do we give them compliments that they deserve? Do we appreciate them the way that they should? Do we give them the ability to make choices in the family as far as, you know, how things are decorated, or what, you know, what things we might want to purchase to put in the home? Do we discuss matters with them to see, well, how is this going to work with your situation? You know, I know you have a lot of things to do, so is it going to be okay if we implement this other step or another measure or something else? You know, I'm kind of being vague here, but the point is husbands and wives work together. And when you love somebody, you're going to come to them and say, here's what I'm thinking about doing. What's your opinion? You discuss it together, and then the husband makes the decision. Here's what we're going to do. And because many times women make very good points that we don't think of. Oh, I didn't even think of that. It's kind of like, you know, the Bible says that there is wisdom in a multitude of counselors. And so when you work at a business, it's not wrong to raise your hand and say, hey, I have a comment. Have you considered doing it this way? Because somebody might go, oh, that's a good point. I am so glad you brought that up. But then when they make the decision, you know, we thought about that, but that's not the way we're going to go. We need to go, okay, that's okay. Because that's having respect for authority. So husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he may sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. And so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. And he who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. And so we wouldn't want to, you know, abuse ourselves. You husbands wouldn't want to abuse ourselves, and we want to try to fulfill our own desires. Well, that's how we should treat our wives. Try to fulfill their desires and to treat them fairly and nice, to treat them good. You know, they deserve it. Now, Peter said something similar in 1 Peter 3. 1 Peter 3. He said something similar in verse 1. He said, "Wives, likewise be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear." And so what this is talking about is if you happen to be married to an unbeliever, you still need to be obedient to your husband. And in your obedience, they might be won over. Oh, wow, that's really attractive. I admire that. I admire their character. And they might be won over. Verse 7 continues to say, "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." So calling the wife, or referring to her as the weaker vessel, is not an insult. Some women would be very insulted by hearing that. It's just a fact of nature that most women are not as strong as men. And that is why we lead to some craziness going on in the world today, where we're allowing some transgender or some men or boys, what have you, that want to identify as a woman, compete in women's sports, and those who compete are winning them, because it's just a fact. They're stronger than most men. They're going to be able to run faster or swim for most of the time. It's not always the case, but most of the time. And it's upsetting. It's ridiculous. It's just a fact. But it's not an insult. I mean, frankly, women should be, you know, pleased. I know I'm pleased with women, you know, being much more soft and feminine and having more curves than men do. I appreciate that. It's attractive to men. In any case, I think this helps us in a way to explain good and bad authority, that the man is the head of the family, but he's not to misuse or abuse his position. He shouldn't expect blind obedience by the wife or even by the children, particularly when we see that some men, their decisions are based on pride or on ego. Fathers, like all authority figures, should be approachable. They should be open to questions, open to suggestions and comments. And the answer should rarely, if at all, ever be, "because I said so." That's just a bad excuse. It really is. And we've all used it. I have used it in the past. And frankly, that type of response of, "because I said so." I've even heard some ministers use that response to questions. One sermon I heard trying to reject the notion that we should not be doing business on the Sabbath by going to restaurants, I heard one minister give a far too long sermon about why it's okay to do business on the Sabbath by eating out at restaurants. And then because he was still getting some, you know, questions and concerns by some of the people in his organization or his congregation, he gave another sermon. And it started off saying, "I gave a sermon about this in the past, and this is the last time I'm going to talk about it." I just shut it off. I didn't even need to hear anymore at that point. I've said what I have said. That's it. So using the response, because I said so, frankly, I think it's done for two reasons. There may be another. You could tell me in Q&A if there's another. But the two reasons that I could think of that people use that response is out of frustration. Sometimes we don't want to explain. We're tired of explaining. It could be that the child is too young to really understand the reason for, you know, why we've made that decision, and we just don't feel like trying to explain it in terms that they could comprehend. But still, I would relate that to being frustrated, out of frustration. We can really explain it in basic terms. We can break it down to basic terms for the younger folk if they don't quite understand our reasoning. And the second reason, I think, why some people might say, because I said so, is because there really is no good answer. But we don't want to admit it. We want to maintain our respect. You need to have respect for me. I said so. That's really not a very good answer. In fact, I don't think that really maintains a level of respect for authority at all. If anything, if we don't explain it to them, here's the reason why, it breeds disrespect for authority, because they're like saying blind obedience. You don't need to know. Just obey me. And if that's what how we want our kids to grow up, it could lead to far worse things in the future. So all parents, I think, have used that excuse at times. Some people, others have used that excuse. Some people in businesses and even statesmen, I think, at times have used a type of response like that. Not those exact words. Frankly, it does more harm than good, and so I think we should really be willing to listen and willing to explain. Listen honestly, sincerely, listen to the question or the concern and be willing to talk about it, to explain, well, here's my reasoning. Because sometimes we're not always right. We're all wrong someplace. We just don't all always know where we're wrong. And sometimes out of the mouth of babes or out of the mouths of those people that might be under our authority, they're going to say, did you consider this? And we'll be like, oh, I did not consider that. And we should appreciate it. We shouldn't look at it as like, you know, being to our discredit. Nobody's trying to bring us down. They're just trying to say, hey, here's how you can do a better job, in their opinion. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes we need to listen. Ephesians chapter 6. So children have their part to play in this as well. They are members of the family who are to obey the parents, much like citizens of a country need to obey the authorities of the country. Galatians. And Paul wrote this in Ephesians 6, in verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. In other words, don't misuse your authority. Don't put unjust or unreasonable demands on children. Do it out of care, out of love. Love your children. So again, this points out that parents, these authority figures, need to be good parents. And we shouldn't expect children to obey directions that are wrong. If we are wrong, we should be willing to explain our reasons. And on the other hand, children, they need to honestly attempt to understand the reasons. You need to be willing to listen to your parents to understand them and not rebel against it just because you don't like the rules. I mean, there are many rules that we have all experienced in life where we're like, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. But we have to do it anyway. We can't be rebellious just because we don't like it. Because they are for the greater good, even if they might not be for our good personally, they are for the good of others at times. There are rules that are put in the workplace that we might not want to obey. You know, one of the rules that was for a brief time and it's already gone was that people had to wear face masks at work in the office. I work in a large office. Those, what do they call them? You know, those cloth masks. So, but that quickly went away because it was something they said, you're kind of impeding on people's rights to not feel restrained by that. Some people don't like it. So, but for the time, I wore them. Wasn't a big deal. I didn't like wearing it, but I didn't, does it really matter? Is this all about me? Or am I trying to help, you know, others that are, might be concerned about being infected with the COVID virus? So I wore it for a time, and then they said, oh, it's optional now. You don't have to wear them. If you're comfortable not wearing them, you don't have to. Just try to maintain your distance from other people. So, but you see people in the office maintaining their distance, and some people are not maintaining their distance. It comes down to a choice you have to make. But are we going to obey the authority because it's for the greater good, or just because, you know, are we going to disobey because we don't like it? Because there's a difference. It's not violating the scriptures to keep your distance from somebody or to wear a face mask when you're sitting having a conversation, trying to explain somebody how to do something. That doesn't violate the scriptures. So what is the harm? And it's actually something good to practice because it shows respect for authority and therefore respect for God, because we all have a boss. My boss downtown has a boss, and their boss has a boss in their house. And the succession just keeps going all the way to God, who is the leading authority of the universe. Parents have a big responsibility in the family to uphold the law, to be honest and fair. But they have a boss to answer to. That's why it says, bring your children up in the Lord, because he is our authority over. And we all need to learn to respect authority. But I think this is often forgotten by some who might be put in positions, whether it's at work or in the church or perhaps in government. There are some people who like to act a little aloof or feel a little aloof, like I'm better than the rest of you people. Keep their nose up a little bit in the air because they think they're better, because they are in a position, a higher position of authority. But having an office of authority does not make anybody special. It doesn't make you special. It's something that is unusual about authority is that those who have more understanding, more responsibility is required. Yeah. More is required of you. There's a principle of this where Christ stated, for everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask more. And James also said, do not let many of you become teachers, knowing that you shall receive a stricter judgment. And the reason is because those people in positions of authority are there to serve others, not yourself. You're not there to misuse the authority. You're there to help guide other people, to help other people. And so if you're going to misguide other people, even by just giving them a bad example of authority, you're going to have the stricter judgment. So something to be very concerned about, those people. Even as parents, we should be very concerned. We don't want to mislead the family. We don't want to mislead our children. So it's fitting, therefore, because we those people that are in these positions do have a large measure of service to other people, it's fitting that Paul said in Ephesians 6 and verse 5, bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart, as to Christ. He's talking about servants that are serving their masters. Serve them with sincerity, as if you're serving Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with goodwill doing service as to the Lord and not to men, not knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Now these words, they have enduring moral principles. They apply to more than just indentured servants. sometimes translated as slaves here. And most adults, in fact, find themselves needing to work to bring in an income to provide for the family. And in this way, well, we become servants to employers or masters. This falls into the same category. And so they pay us for our hours of service. They pay us to do certain tasks, and we have to do those tasks. Or we'll lose our job. We'll lose our income. And there are some people who choose to be self-employed, who want, because they want to be their own boss. I'll be my own boss, make my own rules. Well, it's nice in theory, but technically, if you think about it, when you're self-employed, you actually end up having more bosses because you're usually serving somebody in the community, or you have other people you're doing work for, so you have to answer to other people. So it still falls into the same category, I believe. Ephesians 6 and verse 9, it goes on to talk about masters who are not to abuse their positions of authority, or bosses, or parents. And you, masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. So what he's talking about is you're still going to be judged according to the same rules. You know, there's no partiality with God. Just because you are in a position of authority doesn't mean, oh, you get a free pass. You get to make more mistakes. No, if anything, there's a higher accountability. Because God's rules are the same. They apply to everyone. It's, you know, his commandments, his principles, his moral principles. They're not for one age or any particular age. They're for all ages. And circumstance does not allow us to change the commandment, the fourth commandment. We've seen some people say that circumstance allows us to dine out at restaurants because we live in a unique time. Yeah, we do live in a unique time. It's even easier than ever not to need to dine out at a restaurant. But in any case, our situation doesn't give us the right to alter any one of the commandments or to disrespect authority just because we don't like them. Now, the terminology Paul used here of masters and servants, it sounds taboo in our politically correct society today, but the terms are accurate. They're accurate when describing people in positions of authority who have people working under them. And they're both, as it says, it relates to both. You are both to treat each other respectfully. You both need to treat each other fairly. And so the relationship between a boss and an employee is likened to the relationship between a teacher and a student. That's likened to the relationship between a king and his subjects. It's likened to the relationship between a parent and their child, and also a minister and a lay member. It's likened to the relationship between Christ and the church. It's the same, the master and the servants. And you both treat each other fairly and with respect. 1 Peter 2. With this in mind, not all who had slaves or servants in times past abused their servants. You know, modern historical movies and documentaries today rarely, if ever, portray slaveholders in a positive light. And the reason is because there was widespread abuse of slaves over the last few centuries or more. Perhaps, and probably ever since the beginning of time, or I should say the beginning of when people had slaves. But this was not always the case, and this is definitely not, obviously not what God intended when God found it necessary to have indentured servants in a society of God-fearing people. But this is something that the mobs, the angry mobs, if you let me put it in those terms, like to leave unmentioned. The fact that there are times when it is appropriate to have servants that have masters. But it doesn't mean you abuse those positions. They both treat each other fairly and kindly and with respect. Because when you honestly examine history, we see that there are many who had servants from ancient times, even into the 19th century, who treated those servants, sometimes called slaves, who treated them fairly. I'm not saying this is the majority. I'm not saying that that was common, but it did take place. And so to act like servitude is demeaning and having servants is something that is a crime against humanity, it's not honest. It's a dishonest opinion, and it's a dishonest portrayal of history. It's certainly what God, not what God indicated within the pages of the Old Testament or within the pages of the New Testament. Now, 1 Peter 2 says something similar to what Paul wrote. The Apostle Peter said, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh." So even if a person in a position of authority or view is harsh, who is mistreating you in some way, we're not to return evil for evil. "Vengeance is mine," says God. "I'll take care of it. For this is commendable if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God." Because, and then we're going to get into the example here, because Christ did good, even when suffering wrong. "For to this you are called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his footsteps." Now, I'm currently employed in a large office doing what I feel is important work. And things have been pretty tense over the last few months. It began with only four of us in the office for about a month, and then there was eight, and then 20, and I don't know, we're up to maybe 40 or something now, I'm not sure. But for a few people that are in positions of authority, the bosses, it has been very difficult and frustrating at times. They've done a lot of work, and many of the office managers, or I shouldn't say many, some of the office managers have been a little on edge, and particularly lately. And so I've seen even my boss say some things that were not really right. Now, I'm not saying they used profanities or yelled or screamed at anyone, but, you know, just a little disrespectful. The frustration was kind of showing, and they were letting things out. But still, I have to obey them. I don't go up to them and say, "Hey, you know, you need to really straighten up and do something about that." I obey them because, you know, I understand the frustration, and it's hard on them. And so I have to go obey along with whatever changes they might make in the rules, because they're not telling me to break the commandments. They're just doing what they feel is best for the company and for the project. So most of us, I think, in this way, in some ways, in various ways, depending on, you know, our job or our position in the family or in the church, sometimes we have to go along to get along, knowing that, you know, some of it's just frustration. Some of it's, you know, sometimes people are under pressure. And it's going to simmer down. Things will get better. And even if it doesn't, you know, it's not our place to step in. And so we just go along. They're not telling us to break the commandments. They're not telling us to do something wrong. And the point is that of respect for authority in this world reflects respect for God. And if you'd go back a few verses to verse 13, Peter said, the Apostle Peter said, 1 Peter 2, verse 13, "Therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." It's not for the man's sake. It's for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God. So in this way, we're showing respect for God. We're showing even those people that might be misusing, or I shouldn't say misusing, but making mistakes, or perhaps treating us unfairly at times, that, hey, you know, I'm still going to treat you well. I'm still going to treat you with respect. And like it says about a woman or a man who might be married to an unbeliever, they might be won over by your conduct. Going, wow, that, you know, nobody else was responding in that way when I expressed my frustration, but this employee, I'm going to watch them a little more closely because I like that. I like that attitude. So if we don't always have a boss that is friendly and sweet and giving us compliments, and if we did not have good parents, we still have to be obedient to those people. We still might get an occasional reprimand that it perhaps is undeserved, but we should continue to have respect and obedience to the higher authority, and this is honorable. Even if other people don't take notice, somebody is taking note of it, as Paul and Peter pointed out. God is taking note of it. It's the right thing to do. And Peter gave us an example in 1 Peter 2, verse 21. He said, For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his footsteps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. So consider that Christ understood what he was going to have to go through before he endured it. The evening that it all began, he prayed to God, considering the terrible, the horrific things that he was going to experience. And he prayed in Luke 22:42, he said, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me." He didn't want to experience it. He didn't want to have to go through it, as do we do not want to have to go through some things in life. But he suffered it all. He suffered it all for our sake, but not for ours alone. Many do not realize that Christ's terrible ordeal was something that the Father had told him that he had to do. And that is why he continued in that same sentence. He said, "Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. I'm going to submit to the authority. I'm going to do what needs to be done, even if I don't like it, even if I don't want to do it. I will do it because it doesn't violate the scriptures." So Christ was following the instructions of the leading authority in the universe, and he is called, the author. All things were created by him and for him, as John 1:1 says. Or is it 2? Anyway. But he's also called the author of our eternal salvation. And therefore, when we obey authority in this life, it's attributed to obeying God. And when we choose to reject and to disobey authority in this life, it's likened to rejecting and disobeying God. And we're going to end over here. Well, let's go to John 19 for just a moment. I apologize for taking a little more time than I had planned. This is what happens when I talk off the cuff. John 19, this is a really important point. I want to look at the example here. John 19, in verse 1, we began by talking about Christ and his situation with Pontius Pilate and how he submitted to that authority in Judea at the time. Chapter 19 and verse 1, Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe, mocking him, because purple is the color of authority, mocking him. And then they said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they struck him with their hands. And Pilate, when he went out again, and said to them, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." So he was trying to get out of putting Christ to death, of condemning him to death, of saying, "Look, okay, I punished him. Isn't this enough? You should be satisfied with this." When Jesus came out here wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man!" And therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" But Pilate said to them, "You take him. and crucify him. I find no fault in him. But the Jews answered him, we have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. And therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was more afraid. More afraid. And he had a warning, actually, from his a dream that his wife had about this, saying, don't harm that man. And he went out again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, where are you from? After hearing that he's the Son of God. But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you? And here it is. Who is the real authority? Was it Pilate? Jesus answered and said, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. And therefore, the one who has delivered me to you has the greater sin. So in other words, he could make the decision whether Christ would live or die at that time, but he wasn't the instigator. He wasn't the one desiring for him to die. So he said, basically Christ was saying here, go ahead, make the call. I'm not going to hold it against you. Their sin is greater. They should know better. So Jesus understood clearly the line of authority. He indicated here that it comes from God. He told Pilate that the authority he had came from God, and the authority that Caesar had came from God, for that matter. And the example Christ gave was that he would submit to that authority, even when it was wrong, when it was an unjust court, an unjust decision there. And we're going to read just two lines in 1 Peter 3 to close. So consider this. Has any one of us ever been reprimanded or suffered some kind of wrong for something that we did not do? Yeah, who hasn't, right? Did we take it patiently? Do we take it patiently? Or do we kick and scream and yell and accuse and try to unleash our own form of vengeance? You know, I'm not saying that we should become doormats and allow people to trample all over us and take advantage of us. But think about this when it comes to authority and respect for authority. Pick your fights wisely. Pick the ones that really are just and righteous. Fight the good fight. Don't try to win battles just because of pride or because our feelings were hurt. You hurt my feelings, you know. Because those are the ones, especially when it comes to pride, those are the battles we're going to lose. And if we don't lose them now, we're going to lose them in the end. The Bible never, ever puts pride in a positive light. Not once. And so we are to be subject to the higher authorities and have respect for, even offering our service and support for higher authorities, particularly when it comes to family. Particularly when it comes to brethren, to the church, understand that we're not doing it for their sake alone. We're doing it for God. We're doing it for His sake. And in the end, it is going to be for our own benefit. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8. Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil, reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing.